Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are here with a full boat of our regular crew to talk about something you probably, I bet a lot of you listening to this podcast have already guessed what this podcast is about because, yes, Hurricane Dorian is bearing down on the Florida coast after heading over the Virgin Islands and sideswiping Puerto Rico, and here we all go with another, the first, I guess, of our Atlantic hurricane season to strike the mainland, and we're going to talk about that here in a bit, but of course, we can't go anywhere without our navigator and co-host-in-chief, Sam Bradley.
Wow, look at all those titles. So, sounds good. It seems like these are happening later and later in the season, even kind of when the season used to be over. So we certainly are. We got the whole gang here tonight. Dr. Joe hasn't slipped off yet to parts unknown, but he should be shortly. But we've got both of our meteorologists, Kyle Nelson and Becky DePodwin, and they're going to talk about that level of what they know now in terms of what's happening with the storm. So Becky, let's start with you. What are we looking at in terms of time frames? I know they're projecting like into next week. And, you know, you mentioned there was some uncertainty in the track. How uncertain is that?
That's a loaded question, Sam. So right now, Dorian is a Category 4 hurricane, last I saw, I believe. Kyle, is that correct?
Hey, Becky, I think we're currently sitting at Category 1, projected to be a Category 4 just before landfall.
Okay. So I'm having a hard time keeping up because not even just 24, 36 hours ago, it was tropical storm expected to not really strengthen much more than that. And now we're looking at a Category 4 at landfall sometime overnight Sunday into Monday morning. So as far as timing, that's when, and when we say landfall, it's important to note that we mean that's when the eye of the storm makes landfall and moves inland. However, the impacts can start to be felt in Florida. This is the east coast of Florida and southeast Florida as early as late Saturday, early Sunday morning. So that's going to be tropical storm force winds, probably some rain, potentially some spin up tornadoes in the outer bands. And of course, all of the islands in the Bahamas are going to be experiencing this. This is Thursday through Friday, Saturday, and then into Sunday as Hurricane Dorian tracks toward the coast of the southeast United States. So right now, the National Hurricane Center, who is the authority and the experts on hurricanes, is predicting a landfall. Oh, where would you pinpoint that? Just probably southeast of Orlando and basically due north of Miami. However, that is in the cone of uncertainty. This is Thursday, so we're about 4 to 5 days out from landfall. And the question is always, what does the cone of uncertainty mean? What exactly do we mean when we say that? So essentially, the middle of that cone is the center point of the storm. And the cone represents the probable track of the center of the tropical cyclone. And those are denoted by circles. But the size of each circle is set. And this is going to be a little confusing. Is set so that 2/3 of historical official forecast errors over a 5-year sample fall within that circle. To make that a little bit simpler, essentially it means the center, that the entire track of the cyclone, which is the center of the storm, will remain inside that cone about 60 to 70% of the time. Does that make sense to you all on the phone?
It does. And actually, I shared that video that the Hurricane Center put out. I shared it in the Facebook group because I learned that. I didn't know that was the case, but that basically means, Becky, that there's, you know, 1 out of 3 hurricanes over a 5-year period fall outside the cone, correct?
Yes, essentially. When it's out that far in advance, when we're out to 4 to 5 days.
Right.
Obviously, the cone gets smaller the closer in time you are.
Right.
But basically, it's just a statistical error, and that we don't actually know what's going to happen when it's 5 days out. We're making our best guess, but due to so many different factors and different weather patterns that could be going on, like there's going to be a blocking high just off the coast that's probably going to help suppress Dorian, which is going to keep it a little bit farther to south. At least that's the current forecast, is what's impacting the track right now. But again, we're 5 days out. 4 to 5 days out.
Yeah, it's a lot to keep track of, and I'm glad you explained that. And like I said, I shared the video in the podcast podcast Facebook group because yeah. I learned that from that video. So it was a lot to kind of learn from that. So
yeah, and it's a common misconception that if you are not located inside the cone of uncertainty, that you won't see impacts. And that is absolutely not the case. First off, no matter where you are in the cone and in time, you can certainly experience impacts well outside the center track of the storm. Obviously, the greater impacts are closer to the eye of a hurricane. But even 5 days out, because of uncertainty, even if you were outside of that cone, you may still experience some level of either tropical storm or hurricane force impacts. So that's wind, rain, surge can extend for a great distance away from storms.
I have more questions for you, Becky, but you brought up something. Kyle, what's the difference between if the storm would have weakened and gone back into a tropical depression versus what it's doing now, which is strengthening? What are the factors that make that so?
Oh, heck yeah. So when we look at systems and how they evolve, and specifically tropical systems, and I know Becky's using a phrase tonight, tropical cyclone, that's referring to tropical depressions, tropical storms, and hurricanes. We're kind of lumping those all into one term and kind of differentiating those from our typical low pressure systems that we see over land. But as far as strengthening goes, what we're looking at and what the Hurricane Center is really looking at is that Dorian is moving into an area of low vertical wind shear and warm sea surface temperatures. So those warm sea surface temperatures, that's the fuel for those hurricanes. That's how that energy gets really up and into them to fuel those systems and help them to grow. And vertical wind shear, essentially that's wind that is changing speed or direction as you go up in the atmosphere from the surface on up. And hurricanes don't like vertical wind shear. And as monstrous as they may seem, they're actually very fragile systems. So if they're impacted by, say, like the jet stream or a very a ribbon of wind in the atmosphere, they can actually be sheared or torn apart. So there are some factors, and I believe the phrasing from the National Hurricane Center was at least regular strength or strong strengthening. So they're actually hinting that this may actually intensify more rapidly than they anticipate at this time.
Wow. So Becky, you know, one of the things that Kyle always mentions when we have these discussions is don't get caught up on the category of a storm, because there's so many factors involved in what that is. If you could give us a quick little reminder of those categories and what they mean, and then if you could talk about the potential rain totals, that would be awesome.
Yeah, so the category scale that we use to rate hurricanes is the Saffir-Simpson Hurricane Scale, and it is based on measured wind speed. So we have planes called Hurricane Hunters that fly into hurricanes and take exact specific measurements. And it's once we have those measurements that we can tell what category the hurricane is. So it's a scale from 1 to 5 for hurricanes. Non-hurricane classifications are tropical depression and tropical storm. Once a hurricane reaches above 74 miles per hour or 65 knots, it's a category 1. Once it's above 96 miles per hour or 84 knots, it's category 2. I'll skip the middle parts. But once it reaches above 156 miles per hour or above 135 knots, it's considered a category 5 hurricane. The biggest flaw with the Saffir-Simpson scale, which is pretty commonly agreed on by most meteorologists, is that it only takes into account wind, which is just one of many impacts that hurricanes can bring. Obviously, rainfall is a very common thing. We saw that with Harvey, which was devastating. You have transient tornadoes that can spin up. But the other really major factor here, actually, I'm going to jump back really quick. Inland flooding is also a huge factor from hurricanes and actually can be very deadly. But the other really major impact from hurricanes that is not covered under this is storm surge. And I'm actually going to let Kyle cover that. But Sam, do you want me to talk about rainfall really quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
So at this point, the rainfall isn't expected to be crazy. It's not historic at this point, which I guess given the last couple of years is important to note. Right now, rainfall totals somewhere between 8 to 16 inches across portions of Central Florida. Obviously, you can have much higher localized amounts when a location is under a specific rain band, and those rain bands can set up really anywhere. So right now, anywhere from a foot to as much as the high end, 2 feet of rain from Dorian, which will cause obviously a significant amount of flooding.
Oh boy, as always. I want to get back to Kyle, but Jamie, you wanted to throw in a question.
Yeah, and I just, you talked about the hurricane hunters, and I know, Becky, you got a chance to actually see one up close this past year, correct?
I did. I saw two of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to me that they fly into a hurricane, first of all.
But the
technologies that they use, I mean, they're dropping instruments into the winds, into the hurricane, and then those instruments send back electronic messaging of the actual wind speeds and other data. Talk a little bit about how that really helps them form the picture.
Yeah, so what they drop, they're called radio sons, and there's actually holes in the bottom of the plane where these radio sons come out of. It's really fascinating to see. But yeah, they take in an abundance of measurements, pressure, wind speed. Those are probably the two biggest ones. And we're able to get the way the hurricane flies, we should post a picture of this, actually, of like the path. But it basically flies at different levels within the hurricane and usually makes several passes, or at least a few, depending on how strong the hurricane is, to get a sense of winds at the different levels of the hurricane. Really, the biggest measure of strength, ironically not related to the Saffir-Simpson scale, is pressure. And so we can really tell if a storm is strengthening, if it's weakening, what it's doing based on those different pressure readings over time as the hurricane hunters take time to fly in throughout the storm's life. Did that answer your question, Jamie?
It absolutely did. I remembered seeing you post something about it and a picture of yourself with one of the planes. And I just was like, you know, I thought it might be interesting to kind of talk a little bit about that because I'm always fascinated that they even fly into a hurricane. But then the fact that they kind of zigzag around, like you said, maybe we can get a picture of a flight path, like you said, because they really do stay in there. It's not like they just fly through as fast as they can, like, you know, playing Red Rover in the backyard.
No, they actually fly pretty close to the ocean water too. We should post to this too. There's an absolutely crazy story. It's on Wonderground from Andrew? I believe it's Hugo. No, it's Hurricane Hugo, and I think it's Dr. Rick Knapp and Jeff Masters. It's Dr. Jeff Masters. It's on Wonderground. I'll find the link. Basically, they had a very, very close call in Hugo because they did not recognize how strong the hurricane had actually become. And when they were flying into it, I think they were anticipating like a one or a two, and it was a five at that time. It's an absolutely mind-blowing story.
Yeah, that's kind of a big difference. Kyle, what are we looking at? And there's always the issue of storm surge, and I know it's kind of early to try and get a fix on that, but what do you suspect may be the case, and how far inland might this go? Because as we've learned, we can have flooding quite a bit inland from where the landfall occurs.
Sure, Sam. So we're kind of looking at two different things. So coastal flooding from storm surge, as well as inland flooding from that heavy, persistent rainfall. And those things, especially with this hurricane, are going to occur in very close proximity to each other. So it's too far out right now to really say where exactly the strongest storm surge is going to be, as well as the actual magnitude of it. So how high is that going to be? But folks, especially in the coastal areas, are very often in tune with the tidal patterns. Those are things that we can forecast very confidently. And depending on when those winds arrive, and of course, where the exact track of the hurricane is very a big deal as well, because with the onshore flow, once that wind starts blowing inland, not only do you have the onshore flow, that's that wind-driven water, that's the storm surge, You also have the local upwelling of water, so a local increase in ocean height underneath that hurricane, which is sort of acting like a large vacuum, if you will, on the ocean surface. And then depending on what the current tide level is when all that arrives, that those effects can compound and actually kind of accumulate upon one another to really drive that storm surge very far inland. Right now, it's looking like I would say anyone from Florida all the way through Georgia and into the South Carolina coast, be ready for it. Absolutely. Because like Becky said, once you get out to that 5 days in advance now that this forecast is showing, there's still a lot of uncertainty in where exactly the track of that, the center of that hurricane is going to go. And that is what will ultimately drive the impacts at the local level.
And Kyle, I just wanted to cut in there, but I mean, there's a challenge as well with the coastal inlets and waterways that open into the ocean, because they have a tidal aspect to them as well. And don't they act kind of like funnels where the water gets pushed up into them and caught? That's where a lot of that inland flooding comes from.
Partially, Jamie. That is an absolutely a factor. And with all the different variations in geography and the construction of breakwaters and things like that, of course, it's very, very hyper local in its effects. But you're absolutely right, is that you can get that channeling of water further inland, depending on how those inlets and outlets are shaped. Additionally, you then also run into a system like this currently projecting to drop anywhere from 5 to 10 inches of rain, some places 15 inches of rain. And again, this is 5 days in advance, so we're looking pretty far out at this time. But that much water draining towards the coastal areas, now meeting up with storm surge, forcing water inland, it's going to end up as a big, big problem for those immediate coastal areas.
Yeah, well, right now, the way the maps, I'm sitting here looking at some from the Hurricane Center, it looks like the whole state of Florida might be engulfed in this thing. So, of course, like Becky mentioned, that will change as it gets closer and they have a better idea of where it's going to go. Oh, but my goodness. But one of the things that concerns me, if we think back to 2017, is Puerto Rico that is still trying to recover from those hurricanes back then. We'll talk in a minute about, you know, the response, and there's teams already in Puerto Rico anticipating this, and I know they're anticipating a lot of electrical outages again. I don't know, Kyle, do you have a sense of how far their recovery is and what this might do to them?
Well, Sam, thankfully, Puerto Rico was actually spared a direct hit. They got a glancing blow, if you will, when the storm passed by them. But even though they didn't receive that direct hit, some of the observations, some of the impacts and damage reports that are coming out at this time are showing power outages from winds at or, you know, just above 75 miles an hour, as well as lots of torrential rainfall. There's still many places there that have the blue roof communities. So tarps on the roofs still to this day, and folks that don't have permanent housing, permanent roofs over their head, even like temporary housing and repairs still ongoing. So the infrastructure is slowly being built back, again, still working its way out into the more rural areas, the most rural areas of the island. But yeah, that was the big story, is that they were spared a direct hit, which could have been absolutely devastating, given that some populations still have not even begun their recovery.
Well, I'm glad that wasn't a worst-case scenario for them. They've had enough going on. So, Dr. Joe Holly, it's our turn. Want to talk a little bit about the preparedness efforts from the federal government. You work for FEMA with the Urban Search and Rescue, and I work for it's the Secretary's Office under National Disaster Medical System on a DMAT, which is a Disaster Medical Assistance Team. It's a very long title. Anyway, all of them, I understand the USARs are on alert that you may be going out in the next few days. So do you want to talk a bit for the fact we have new listeners that may not have heard some of this before? What is a USAR? What do you do? What is your role? And what do you expect to see?
Well, hi, Sam, and everybody, and thanks for all the really great news that you've shared about the potential for Hurricane Dorian. I'm really looking forward to it. So, as Sam mentioned, I am the medical director for a federal urban search and rescue task force. That's what USAR is. And we fall under the FEMA umbrella, so emergency response, that kind of thing. The focus of a federal USAR team is to be able to respond within a few hours of notification and travel to an area that's been significantly impacted and overwhelmed by whatever the disaster is. And to bring with us some capabilities that are fairly sophisticated and many times are needed because the local resources are overwhelmed or some of those capabilities, for example, search and rescue in a urban environment with collapsed structures that are, you know, heavy concrete and steel buildings and that kind of stuff, frequently are beyond the scope of some fire departments and that sort of stuff. So that's really the function of the USAR system. We're designed to be the first in from the federal standpoint and to assist the locals with whatever we can assist them with, whether it's wide area search to confirm that they're not victims trapped in houses and that sort of stuff, to handling collapsed buildings and assisting with communications and logistics and all kinds of other stuff. And then once that mission is complete, usually within a couple of weeks or so, we are out of there. Sam, you're on the DMAT side. That's the Disaster Medical Assistance Team side. And that is really through Health and Human Services, not FEMA. And the function there is really to, I think the easy way to sort of think about a DMAT is it's very much like an emergency department in a tent. So a DMAT can come into an impacted area, set up a facility, and start taking care of the local population and others, and can stay there for months in some cases, supplementing the local medical infrastructure until that system gets back up and on its feet again.
Exactly. And if you can imagine the cash that has to go with the DMAT, say, where, of course, the size of the team could be anywhere from a strike team to 100 people, depending on what they want to configure. But everything goes with them. Everything they need for the people, which is the tent, which is all the bandaging supplies and the pharmacopoeia and the, you know, that which they need to keep people there for a certain length of time. Forgot something here. But the idea is, like you said, Joe, we can support a hospital that's had infrastructure damage. We can set up a standalone in an area that may not have, you know, any resources whatsoever, because, of course, the hospitals always have to be evaluated for their ability to function. We can work with them and put together like a first stopping point and taking care of a lot of things that the ER doesn't need to have if the ER is functioning, or can function on our own for 72 hours without any outside help. And then after that, we have to look for some more resources. But that's what we do. We basically set up a mobile ER and we go to work. Jamie, any questions from you so far?
No, not really. I think this is a great option for us to just review this stuff. We have a lot of new listeners at all the time, and it's important for us to review the status of what's been going on. You know, I know, Joe, last year with the hurricane season, you saw a lot of action and a lot of activity with with the team and with various aspects of response. You know, hopefully we don't see that same level, but you know, it is important that, I think Florida has made some significant changes since Irma just a few years ago to how they handle things like, you know, nursing homes and, you know, checking in on people in different facilities because of some of the situations that occurred back during Irma, which is nice to see. You know, that's one of the most important things we do, Joe, isn't it? To learn the lessons from previous events so that we don't repeat those mistakes.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Jamie. You know, I think I've certainly noticed in the last few years major strides in several different states that have had pretty significant storm impacts in the past. And it is clear that the system continues to evolve and get better, and people learn from past issues and mistakes and positive things as well. So, you know, that the technology continues to improve that we utilize. I think the a recognition by politicians and bureaucrats, for lack of a better term, to appreciate the incredible value and ability of very knowledgeable and experienced people in emergency response. And they're sort of the forgotten, unsung hero. You know, you don't need those guys until you need them, and then you really need them bad. And it shows very much whether or not you've been paying attention or not when the situation goes south, and you do indeed need those guys.
Exactly. Well, kind of on that note, we talked about preparedness in every possible form, but people still don't pay attention. I would expect that people that live in Florida would be very well versed on this, unless they just moved there. But I want to cover just some of the things that are most important. I think planning ahead is way up there because, you know, plan for the worst. As Joe mentioned offline here, you know, you go to Costco to get bottled water. People have already sold out. I mean, you got to plan way ahead. Have some already stored at your home and food and all the other things that we talk about. Becky, what are some of your thoughts on preparedness?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head, Sam, when you said prepare ahead of time. And that's really what anybody who lives in a hurricane-prone area should be doing. So that's it's everything from having water, having a generator, which it was really a wake up call for a lot of people on the East Coast after Sandy, having non-perishable food. And so some of these things are things that you can do well ahead of time. So, you know, when you start hearing the word hurricane season, you know, in May and June, that's when you start checking your supplies. You have a lot of this food. You have, you know, gallon water that stays good for a very long time. Do you have a to-go kit, which includes any number of things? I would recommend Googling Red Cross Emergency Go Kit. They have a really good list of supplies that you should have in that. You know, things like radio, batteries, or first aid kits, a whistle. Sounds like an odd thing, but if you're trapped, that's a little bit more for tornadoes, but can also apply to hurricanes. Making sure your vehicle is in good working order in case you have to evacuate. Having a communications plan for your family. What if something happens quickly and you need to get everybody together in a quick manner? What happens if the cell phone towers go down? How are you going to communicate with people? It's honestly a lot to think about. And as human nature goes, when we are under stress and under duress, we're not necessarily going to be thinking the clearest. And this has, you know, been proven with a lot of different studies, a lot of different case studies. In situations, people tend to not make the right or most accurate decision when under stress. So if you have all of these items lined up, you have a plan in place, you have these supplies, it doesn't require a lot of thinking to do the right thing when you have to act quickly. And the good thing, final point, the good thing with hurricanes, a weird thing to say, but you do actually generally have a fair amount of lead time. So you have several days where you can monitor, you can make plans and preparations, either plans to hunker down and stay if it's not going to be as bad where you are, or figure out your evacuation route, figure out those shelters, you know, and always include your pets. Make sure the shelter you're going to, if evacuating includes pets, make sure you have their food, their supplies, their medicines. I think that's all I got.
Becky, you're a walking encyclopedia. I can't believe you got touched on all those points. Jamie?
I may or may not have had to write a lot of this today for work.
Well, no, and Becky's right. And I'm one thing that you didn't mention, Becky, although I know it's on almost every list I've ever seen. So people that are looking for those lists will see it, is cash, which when the power is out, merchants are more than happy to sell you stuff, but you need, if they don't have their machines running to take credit cards, and they don't want to take a check, cash is king. And
yep,
so,
you're exactly right.
You know, hit your bank and get enough, as much cash you can afford. I think one guy on the news today said, look, you know, you can put it back when the hurricane goes by. You can go back to the bank and put the cash right back in your account. But take it out now. The amount you think you might need is just a good sense thing to do. And the other thing about preparedness is Joe mentioned this, the government leaders listening to emergency planners. You know, the governor of Florida, we're 5 days out from landfall, and the emergency declaration for the entire state has already been made, which gives them additional resources to get more gasoline in so that the gas stations aren't running out of fuel, so people can evacuate or can fuel up their generators. There's more bottled water coming into the state. All those resources are enabled because of the emergency declaration. And so that's part of that preparedness plan as well at the state level. So there's a lot of things that come together for this. But again, like Becky said, some of this can be done months or even a year in advance.
Yes, don't be complacent. Joe?
So I think in regards to preparedness, I agree 100% with everything you guys have just said, but I think it says a lot for how the system responds now compared to how it used to. It used to be very reactive, and I think what we see now is much more proactivity and better planning and better resource positioning and management. So, for example, FEMA's had a couple of USAR task forces and an advanced element in Puerto Rico for probably 4 days now. And those guys were all there in preparation for, you know, whatever was going to happen there or Virgin Islands or wherever else things were going on. And, you know, now we're shifting the focus to Florida and elements are moving and things are happening so that there'll be pre-positioned assets in place prior to the storm hitting with the ability to, cover that storm should it cross all the way across Florida and re-strengthen in the Gulf and, you know, continue along someplace else.
Kyle, you just made a good point. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure, Sam. Just kind of going quickly back to the cash thing. Small bills, small denominations. Otherwise, think about it, that $2 Gatorade just became 20 bucks if you hand him a $20 bill. But also another important point that was highlighted by Jamie and Joe is that, I mean, that disaster declaration for the state of Florida for all the counties was signed 2 p.m. yesterday. So 5 full days in advance of when the projected impacts to the state of Florida were to start. And even just looking back, you know, 10 years ago, that's almost unheard of for not just for emergency management, for decision makers, and most importantly, our politicians who are in these positions of power to support our, you know, the state and the local responders and their communities having confidence in these forecasts that are being put out by the National Hurricane Center. It's absolutely phenomenal to think about that and just how far we've come. And it'll be really interesting to see just how far we'll continue to go as our science advances and as the understanding of our an interpretation of those forecasts becomes more and more savvy amongst the population.
Wow, yes, very true. So for those of you that were listening back in 2017, it got pretty crazy because both Joe and I were deployed not once, not twice, but three times because of the different storms going through. So I don't anticipate that this year, but Joe most certainly will go out. I may, even though our team isn't on call till October, but they're starting to move teams up because so many have been pre-staged that are on call in September. So we'll see what happens. But, you know, one thing that's kind of cool for those of you that have listened during a deployment is getting tips from the field from either Joe and or myself. And Jamie and the meteorologist kind of hold down the fort. So, Jamie, you want to talk about how that works a little bit?
So what we've done in the past and what we will always strive to do is when appropriate and when the teams that are deployed to the field are available, we'll try to catch up with them. I'm pretty flexible. I work from home, and so I'm able to, you know, if Joe reaches out to me or Sam reaches out to me and says, hey, what are you doing at 2 o'clock this afternoon? If I can get free at all, I'll swing down and we'll do a 10-minute or 15-minute call to just kind of get an update on what the status is for teams that are moving into the field and what everybody is doing and what they expect to be doing next. And we put those out as quickly as we can. So in past deployments, when we've had back-to-back storms, we've put out podcasts, maybe 10 podcasts in the space of 2 or 3 weeks. And they've been shorter in many cases. And then while Sam and Joe are deployed, Becky and Kyle and I get together and kind of review what happened and how accurate were the forecasts and what were we expecting. And all those things go into kind of us doing an after action report on what we reported on. And I think that that's valuable for the podcast people listening, as well as to kind of give a background for those updates from the field when we can get them. And Kyle, and you and I have done this most often, but Becky's been part of it as well. But do you have anything to add to some of the things we've put in there in the past?
No, I think it's good. And I'll tell you what, though, if our listeners are interested in hearing anything specific or want us to cover anything, please keep giving us that great feedback in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, if you see an interesting article about the event, about the hurricane from a reputable source, you're more than welcome to share that in the Disaster Podcast group because I try to keep my eyes open for what's going on out there, but I don't see everything. So that's what it's there for. It's not just for there for me or the rest of the team here from the podcast itself to post, but we want members of the podcast community to post as well. And if you have a question about a given news item, ask the question and tag one of us or a couple of us in it. If we can get an answer for you from the rest of the community, we will definitely do so. Sam?
I agree. So hold on to your shorts and we'll see what's coming. Hold on to your shorts, Florida. Hopefully it won't be a worst case scenario. So Joe, this is what you prepare people for, isn't it? When you're doing your work with Paragon, even though you do everything from active shooter to these kinds of natural disasters, God, there's just so much to learn. So tell us a little bit about what you guys got going on with Paragon.
Well, you're right. That's a lot of what's happening. We've been quite busy recently with special operations guys in the military and a couple of things a little bit further out related to some of the CPR research and stuff that we've been doing. We just finished a disaster preparedness and procedure lab for a big trauma system just south of us about 2 weeks ago. So got a little break just in time to go respond to a couple of hurricanes.
Yeah, and Joe, you know, thanks so much for your support here of the podcast. Just to let the folks know, where can they find you? Because, you know, when they're looking at this event coming up and seeing the effects of the hurricane, and they wonder, well, you know, we've got a small local USAR team. What could we do to train them better? They could be bringing Paragon in with the specialists and the experienced USAR team members that you bring into the field. How can they reach out to you to kind of find out how they can bring that training to them?
Well, we would absolutely love to do that for them, Jamie. They can give us a call or reach out to us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com. We've got a Facebook page under the same name, and they can always get us through the Disaster Podcast.
Awesome. Becky, where can folks follow you? I know you'll be tweeting a lot of weather-related stuff in the coming days and week.
Yeah, I will. So most of that will be on Twitter. You can find me at WX_BECKS, or just search Becky D. Podwin, exactly as it sounds. And I'm also happy to answer any questions, have any discussions in the Disaster Podcast Facebook group. And there's been a few posts there lately that have kind of sparked some discussion, gotten some feedback from both Kyle and I. I think it's a really valuable resource to talk about anything weather emergency management related.
Awesome. And Kyle, what about you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to follow along or connect with me on LinkedIn.
Excellent. And Sam, last but not least, you might be in the field and maybe making some posts along the way. Where can folks find out what you've been up to?
Well, the usual social media places, as Kyle does. Becky seems to focus most on Twitter and Kyle on LinkedIn, but I kind of hang around Facebook. So you can find me there in the Facebook group, on the other sites under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. What about you, PodMedic?
Well, you said it, PodMedic in most social media places. So please friend or follow me on those locations. I tend to be more on Facebook and then a little bit on Twitter and everything else as I am inclined to do so. So you'll definitely find me in the Facebook group for the Disaster Podcast, though. So find us over there. If you haven't already joined and become a member of the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, just go to Facebook, search for Disaster Podcast, and request to join the group. We'd love to have you in. And as soon as I see those notifications, or any of us do, we kind of go in and approve it. So we'd love to have you in the community and start sharing your expertise and your questions with the group. Sam, you know, this has been a great episode, and I think it's always good to do these kinds of reviews of what we do and what to expect from these upcoming major disaster events.
Absolutely, and I think it goes without saying, disaster weather is not our everyday weather.